Welcome you all to our Personal Theology Speaker Series. And I'm so happy to welcome back Stephen Herman this morning, who's been kind enough to come here for a number of years now and give us his very thought-provoking topics. And he likes our group so much, he's volunteered to come back again in the spring semester. So thank you so much, Stephen, for sharing all your time with us. Stephen is a Jungian psychotherapist who's been practicing for over 29 years, and he has a clinical practice in Oakland in which he uses dream work, journaling, and poetry, among other therapeutic methods. He's taught courses at the Jung Institutes in San Francisco, Chicago, and Zurich, as well as at UC Berkeley, UC Santa Cruz, and Yale University. Stephen is also nationally and internationally recognized writer, author of 4 books, as well as over 30 publications, and we do have some of them for sale over here for $20 each following the presentation. And they're hardback books, so $20 is a good price. And his writings reflect his avid studies on C.G. Jung, Teilhard de Chardin, Meister Eckhart, and Swami Vivekananda, as well as the writings of Walt Whitman, Herman Melville, and Emily Dickinson. And his latest book, which is about ready to publish, is called Emily Dickinson, A Medicine Woman for Our Times. So he'll come back and talk about that maybe in the spring. But today his topic is the future of transpersonal psychology. So let's give a very warm welcome to Stephen Herman.
Well, good morning. Thanks for coming, and I see some familiar faces, and it's good to be here again. This morning I'm going to be speaking about a subject that does have some links to the UU, and that's the emergence of the field of transpersonal psychology and its future. Anthony Suttich wrote a paper called The Emergence of the Transpersonal Orientation, a personal account, how the founding of the Journal of Transpersonal Psychology emerged through conversations that took place between Abraham Maslow, Stanislav Grof, and Suttich between 1967 and 1968. This was a turning point in American psychology. The ideas for Maslow's popular book, The Further Reaches of Human Nature, were first introduced, moreover, in a talk to a large audience in San Francisco at the Unitarian Church on September 14th, 1967. So this was a real turning point in modern psychology. I thought you at the UU personal theology program might appreciate this interesting piece of synchronicity or coincidence. In the Bay Area here, Suttich wrote to Maslow after the UU talk, "I consider your lecture at the Unitarian Church a historic occasion. It was the first public reference to the, quote, fourth force in psychology that I know of." So I'm going to be speaking about transpersonal psychology as the fourth force in psychology that Abraham Maslow named for us at that historic moment at the Unitarian Church. Most of my talk this morning is going to be coming from a paper that was published in the Integral Transpersonal Journal of Art, Sciences, and Technologies in Milan, Italy. The paper came out of a seminar that I gave at Sophia University in Palo Alto in September, 2 years ago, 2015. And the the paper was subsequently published by the Italian editor, who happened to be in the audience and asked me to submit it to his journal, and I was happy to do so. So what I'm going to do is give you a little bit of background on the field of transpersonal psychology. Excuse me. How it was named and who the key figures were in the early emergence of the field. And then talk a little bit later and hopefully engage you in some dialogue about what the possible future of the field is and what its relationship is to Unitarian Universalism. So amongst the earliest pioneers who are commonly considered to have laid the cornerstone for the field of transpersonal psychology are William James, the father of American psychology and author of the very well-known book, The Varieties of Religious Experience. C.G. Jung, Roberto Assagioli, the Italian psychoanalyst, and Abraham Maslow. So as I mentioned, Maslow can be credited with having named the fourth force in psychology, transpersonal, to distinguish it from psychoanalysis, behaviorism, and humanistic psychologies. However, it was Carl Jung who was the first to distinguish his school of analytical psychology from Freudian psychoanalysis in 1912. And his demarcation was drawn clearly over the issue of the personal and the collective, or the transpersonal unconscious. So as we'll see in the talk this morning, Jung made good use of the word transpersonal in his volume Two Essays on Analytical Psychology. This was published in 1917, where he used the term synonymously with the term collective unconscious. However, Jung's original usage of the term in German was the word überpersönlich, which means over the personal or above the personal. The translators of the collected works of C.G. Jung translated as transpersonal, meaning beyond the personal. So that's something to keep in mind today, because there's an important distinction between the spiritual path of transpersonal psychology that's gone more in the direction of a line of continuity that can be drawn directly from the teachings and writings of Swami Vivekananda, who was here in 1900 and started the Vedanta Center in San Francisco, and who I've spoken about with some of you who were here before, and Sri Aurobindo. Sri Aurobindo played a very important role in influencing not only the emergence of the California Institute of Integral Studies in San Francisco, which has a very transpersonal focus, as well as the founder of ESLIN. So he's a very important figure in the emergence of the field in the 60s, Sri Aurobindo. And Aurobindo said that he took his integral psychology from the Vedanta, it followed out of the writings of Vivekananda, who sat at the feet of Ramakrishna. So there's a marriage of East and West in the field of transpersonal psychology that starts with the influence of Indian spirituality, Hindu, or Vedanta and integral spirituality, and that's the more recent emergence in the 60s. Now, as you know, the 60s was a very experimental time. We had Timothy Leary, we had the experimentation with mescaline and psilocybin and LSD. I mean, these were times of experimentation with psychoactive hallucinogenic drugs. And then out of that came Ram Dass also, who went to India and brought back his own version of a teaching. So it's out of that movement in the 60s that all of you know about that the field of transpersonal psychology had its real bursting forth, its emergence. My interest in this, of course, goes back to my own development. I grew up in this 60s and 70s, and went to UC Santa Cruz in 1978, and humanistic psychology and transpersonal psychology were everywhere. School in Palo Alto that I taught at 2 years ago, Sophia University, was originally founded by James Frazier in 1975, and that's the ITP, the Institute for Transpersonal Psychology. There's also a transpersonal psychology at John F. Kennedy University, as well as a transpersonal program in Sonoma State. So the Bay Area really, it was a pivotal place for the emergence of these ideas and the definition of transpersonal values. But I think that going back to the roots of the field might give us a historical perspective on what the earlier influences were. And as I've mentioned before, Vivekananda played a very important role in that. However, from the field of psychology, it was the American psychologist William James who really was the first transpersonal psychologist. And he had a direct influence on Carl Jung, who Jung met at Clark University in 1909, along with Sigmund Freud and Sandor Ferenczi. It was a real inspiration for Jung to meet William James, and his writings played a very significant role in the development of Jung's ideas about psychology and religion. So I thought that giving you a little bit of background on William James might help you see this line of development, and then we could talk about where the field might be going. So the earliest usage of the term transpersonal is in lecture notes that William James left in a talk he gave at Harvard University in 1906. Now, this is the same year he came to lecture at Stanford University. He was present at the 1906 earthquake and described his experience of the walls waggling and the chimneys moving, and he had a mystical experience during the earthquake and describes it. Prior to that, in 1898, James had lectured at UC Berkeley here, and it was at that time that the pragmatist movement was named. So pragmatism was very important in the development of James's thoughts about religious experiences. Now, the background of this goes to discussions that William James was having with a very good friend of his who was also a professor at Berkeley and later took William James's post at Harvard when he was on sabbatical. And his name was Josiah Royce. And Royce was a very important philosopher here in the Bay Area. He grew up in Grass Valley. And he was a neo-Kantian. So the arguments between William James and Royce really helped shape the direction of James's psychology. And the argument that broke out was over the question of the absolute. Because in Kantian philosophy, there were references to, you know, God as the absolute, with a capital A. And, of course, Kantian philosophy was largely shaped by, centuries of Christian theology. And so James, as the American, who was, by the way, the godson of Ralph Waldo Emerson. Emerson was present not long after William James's birth to bless him as a baby. So James grew up hearing dialogues at the dinner table between his father, who was a Swedenborgian, and Ralph Waldo Emerson, who, as you know, defected from the Unitarian Church after the Divinity School address and played a seminal role in shaping the future direction of Unitarian Universalism. So that was a very important influence on William James, that from his very earliest days, he learned directly from Emerson. And as I've spoken before about Walt Whitman, Emerson was the catalyst for Whitman's own development of his personal religion. In America, and he called it religious democracy. I've used the term spiritual democracy in my book, which I spoke about here before. The Wisdom of Early American Visionaries for the Journey Forward. Emerson, Whitman, Herman Melville, Emily Dickinson, they all played a really important defining role in shaping this evolution. Let me give you a couple of passages from William James to help you see why he's so important in this. In 1883, he began to speak about the wonderful stream of our consciousness. And how to tap into this wonderful stream of our consciousness was the main question he set out to answer. He would write in Principles of Psychology that the state of our consciousness is peculiar. There's a gap therein. But no mere gap. It is a gap that is intensely active. So this gap was really an opening in the ego consciousness to the sea of what he was to call the transpersonal self. He wanted to operate as a scientific researcher through an opening in a doorway to this mother sea. You know, he spoke a lot of a subliminal door in varieties of religious experience. One method James experimented with early on in his explorations of this gap into the subconscious self was automatic writing. Automatic writing is thinking and suspending our critical faculties and writing down our feelings, ideas, and fantasies in the now, in the rush of the moment. When you take out a pad of paper and a pen or pencil or a laptop computer and begin writing, whatever comes to your mind is what you put down, without any interruption and without any conscious judgment. Then you're in the stream. Then you are open to the gap that is intensely active. And this is automatic writing. Automatic writing had emerged as a method of activating the subconscious with the advent of spiritism. But its uses were taken over by scientists and psychiatrists, such as James's friend Frederick Myers and Pierre Janet in Paris, who used it systematically. James felt from the start of his reading of Pierre Janet's works that his researches in France had inaugurated a whole new path of exploration, a shift from experimental to laboratory psychology, and towards clinical and therapeutic psychotherapy through the treatment of nervous disorders. What fascinated James were Janet's writings on fixed ideas that arrive subsequent to psychic trauma. Trauma is an area of research in which I have a bit of experience, yet much of what we know today about the treatment of trauma begins with Pierre Janet. After reading Janet, James wrote incisively, "The nucleus of these subconscious fixed ideas usually consists of reminiscences of the shock by which the mind was originally shattered." James referred to such traumatic shocks as, quote, thorns in the spirit, so to speak. The cure is to draw them out in hypnotism. So they were using hypnosis to work with psychological trauma. Let them produce all their emotional effects, however violent, and work themselves off. Another technique for accessing these subconscious ideas, other than hypnotism, one that James, Janet, Jung, and Freud were all using to explore the subconscious, was the free flow of writing. Writing automatically without conscious censorship. And we see this now in the publications of Jung's Red Book in 2009. Now we can see how he experimented with this method. James was very interested in psychical research. He worked with psychics. He was interested in the occult. This was really outside the field of traditional academic psychology. He was interested in marginal states and getting outside the margins of ego awareness into this place, which he called the subconscious Mother Sea. And in there, he said, there is a subliminal door. Now, what happens when one steps through that door was James's primary interest. And that, you could say, is the beginning of a psychological approach, a research, scientific research of the transpersonal levels of the unconscious. I experimented myself with automatic writing when I wrote my book, The Shaman's Call, William Everson. After calling in sick for work for 4 days, and just writing for a period of time nonstop, and pretty much while listening to, you know, Bach's Art of the Fugue and the other marvelous pieces of classical music up in the Arinda Hills. And I just wrote and I wrote and I wrote, and I just felt this opening. This is, I think, what Emerson was trying to convey to the young William James at the dinner table, was how language, how poetry, because he also was quite a poet, Emerson, and writing could free up the mind, free up imagination, free up the creative process, so that one could have these experiences without needing to take drugs. Now, James did experiment with government-sponsored peyote, he says he didn't have any hallucinogenic experiences, and he only vomited from having ingested the peyote buttons. So apparently it didn't really do much for him, and he himself had his own method. of accessing the transpersonal. And one of the beautiful essays he wrote in 1906 was called The Energies of Men. He said, "Ask a scientific psychologist to predict what symptoms a patient must have when his supply of mental energy diminishes and he can only utter the word fatigue." Have you all felt that, that fatigue? And so how do we get more energy? You see, William James was interested in how we can tap reservoirs of motivation inside of ourselves that we didn't even know we had. And he was looking for techniques to help people tap into these reservoirs. "Compared with what we ought to be," he wrote, "we are only half awake. Conscience makes coward of all of us. Social conventions prevent us from telling the truth, and our scientific respectability keeps us from exercising the mystical portions of our nature freely." In the field of transpersonal psychology, scientific research and the study of spiritual experiences go hand in hand. Mysticism and science stand together side by side. When both work together, it can be productive of great sums of psychic energy. This is what I experienced in late February 1991 after my 35th birthday. The Energies of Men was delivered as the presidential address before the American Philosophical Association at Columbia University on December 28, 1906. James boldly stated that such emergent phenomena as new thought, Christian science, and metaphysical healing were so numerous in his day that he saw in them a, quote, "great spiritual movement of tremendous religious force. The ideas here," James said, "are healthy-minded and optimistic. And it is quite obvious that a wave of religious activity, analogous in some respects to the spread of early Christianity, Buddhism, and Mohammedanism, is passing over our American world." It's pretty powerful. James called for a scientific psychology book to address the most important question of how to help produce what he called an efficiency equilibrium. He was speaking about how to increase the amount of available energy in the nervous system and neural pathways. "To have this level raised," James said, "is the most important thing that can happen to a man. Yet in all my reading, I know of no single page or paragraph of a scientific psychology book in which it receives mention." James went on, "Most of us feel as if we lived habitually with a sort of cloud weighing on us, below our highest notch of clearness and discernment. Sureness in reasoning or firmness in deciding, the existence of resources of energy that habitually are not tapped, is most familiar to us in the phenomenon of the second wind. Ordinarily, we stop when we meet the first defective layer, so to call it, of fatigue. But if an unusual necessity forces us to press onward, a surprising thing occurs. The fatigue gets worse up to a certain critical point, when gradually or suddenly it passes away, it vanishes, and we are fresher than before. We've evidently tapped a level of new energy, masked until then by the fatigue obstacle usually obeyed." The fatigue obstacle usually obeyed. There may be layer after layer of this experience. A third and a fourth wind may supervene beyond the very extremity of fatigue distress. Amounts of ease and power we never dreamed ourselves to own. Sources of strength habitually not taxed at all, because habitually we never push through the obstruction, never pass those early critical points. When we do pass, What makes us do so? He asks. Either some unusual stimulus fills us with emotional excitement, or some unusual idea of necessity induces us to make the extra effort of will. Excitements, ideas, and efforts, in a word, are what carries us over the dam. Most of us may learn to push the barrier further off and live in perfect comfort on much higher levels of power. So here's that idea of the higher levels of power. I mentioned that Jung had originally used the word überpersönlich, above the personal. Well, this is something I'll talk a little bit about as we move on, because it happened to have been the very issue that drew a line of demarcation between Jamesian pragmatism, Jungian psychology, and the spiritual practices of the East, of India primarily, of the Vedanta, Vivekananda, or Aurobindo, that there is a difference in the way in which they practice and talk about transpersonal psychology and transpersonal energy. So here's James talking about this gap in our consciousness and this subliminal door and what happens when you pass through that door and into these, quote, extra marginal fields outside the margin of our ordinary awareness. He says we can arrive at what he calls a bursting point. The way energies or powers in the extra marginal field get into us, he added, is through what I mentioned before, he called the subliminal door. And Lori and I have this marvelous photograph that I took when we were in Chaco Canyon, New Mexico, of these doorways. That there's like five successive doorways that just open up, and there's this golden light. And you think about the ancient Anasazi peoples of indigenous America and how the creation of that architectural structure in what's now considered to be an astronomical site, that they really used it to study the stars. And the alignment of those doorways really suggests an opening to the cosmos. And that's exactly what James was writing about. The movement beyond the preoccupation with a single image of God to something more universal. Now, there was a very interesting... well, let me read, first of all, a passage about this... this transitional point. 1896, this is a very important year in the development of James's ideas. Why? Because who came to Harvard University in that year? Swami Vivekananda. He lectured two times. James met him twice. And Vivekananda's ideas had a very powerful shaping influence on the development of his book, The Varieties of Religious Experience. Here's what James wrote in 1896 as he was beginning to get, things were beginning to boil. As Whitman said, I was simmering, simmering, simmering. Emerson brought me to a boil. You know, I think that in a way, Vivekananda brought James to a boil. And it shows how powerful the influence was of Indian spirituality on his thoughts and ideas. He wrote to his friend Rankin in the same year, I'm more interested in religion than in anything else, but with a strange shyness of closing my hand on any definite symbols that might be too restrictive. So I cannot call myself a Christian. And indeed, I go with my father, the Swedenborgian, in not being able to tolerate the notion of a selective personal relation between God's creatures and God himself as anything ultimate. I envy you the completeness of your Christian faith and the consciousness of association between your abstract theism and the Christian symbols. I shall work out my destiny and possibly as a mediator between scientific agnosticism and the religious view of the world. Now, this term scientific agnosticism was also used by Carl Jung in a letter. So it's a very interesting idea that places James and Jung in a neutral zone with regards to the whole issue of religion. So I shall work out my destiny and possibly as a mediator between scientific agnosticism and the religious view of the world, Christian or not. I may be more useful than if I were myself a positive Christian. The doorway into the subject, James continued in Varieties of Religious Experience, seems to me to be the best one for a science of religions. A science of religions. For it mediates between a number of different points of view. Yet it is only a doorway, and difficulties present themselves as soon as we step through it and ask how our transmarginal consciousness, transmarginal is that word, carries us if we follow it on the remoter side. Here the overbeliefs begin. Here mysticism and the conversion rapture of Vedantism, Vivekananda, and transcendental idealism bring in their monistic interpretations and tell us that the finite self rejoins the absolute self, for it was always one with God and identical with the soul of the world. So William James, he did not take the narrow view of religion. Rather, he adopted the empirical view, as Carl Jung later would, that no one symbol of divinity can ever possibly encapsulate the totality of the absolute, the very thing that he and Josiah Royce had been arguing about, this notion of the absolute in Kantian idealism. God or the transcendental reality, which can never fully be fathomed, nor be fully known except through momentary revelations of spiritual experience made possible through openings in this subliminal door. The idea of a gap to the objective vision of radical empiricism or religious science was presented for the first time by James during his appointment, decided in January 1898 as the Gifford Lecturer at the University of Edinburgh during the 1899 to 1900 and 1900 to 1901 periods. So out of these lectures, we have now the text, The Varieties of Religious Experience, which were originally his talks there in Edinburgh. So 1898 marks a real turning point in William James's life. He was from the start of his career a pragmatist who was out to prove scientifically that God exists. But he wasn't going to settle for any narrow view. He was going to look at all of the documents and compare them side by side and arrive pretty much at the conclusion of what the Unitarian Church has regarding the notion of divinity. That there are many experiences of divinity and theologies. His main business was the study of the psychology of religious experience, and one of his fiercest battles for the absolute was the battle with monism. Pragmatism, on the other hand, is the psychology of action, living intensely and in the most positive sense. Positive psychology really comes out of James's writings, too. Possible in the now, in the moment. He's very much focused on living in the present. The story of how the Gifford lectures came into being is interesting from an empirical angle. In his book, A Pluralistic Universe, he said God the God of our popular Christianity is but one member of a pluralistic system. And the absolute is an improbable hypothesis. So I've mentioned the disagreement that broke out really between the arguments between James and his friend Josiah Royce over the question of the absolute. Here's a very interesting thing that he wrote in 1897. I don't think that's the correct date, actually. I can get that for us later if someone has a desire to know where this quote's from. He said, "Now, if this feeling of Q," and he used a small Q, he wrote it in an essay called "The Function of Cognition." If this small Q be the only criterion of the God, it will, of course, form the entire universe. So every religion argues that its God is the absolute, and that's it. Case closed. James believed the jury was not out yet. The reason the absolute is an important concept to comprehend for transpersonal psychology is that it opens up wide a whole field of comparative religion and mystical states and world spirituality, which is at the center of transpersonal research. If there is an absolute, is there an absolute, or are all the gods and goddesses merely relative? Let's see. So I brought a diagram here. So I don't know if everybody can see it, actually. So if Q, the small Q, were to represent an infinite number of absolutes, this equation would therefore negate finally that there is one absolute. The only reliable absolute would then be the many and the one. Or capital Q equals cosmos, and I put its creator. Thus the relativity of the gods. So you see how important James was as a father of American psychology. He was out to prove the existence of God through the science of religions, but he wanted to make it universal, you see. Or he was, let's just put it this way, he was led to postulate the universality of the God concept in all religions as being valid. Now, some of the arguments that he had with his friend Josiah Royce are really quite interesting and even humorous at times. There's a very famous picture of William James and Josiah Royce seated on a rock in Tennessee, and the photographer caught William James right in the moment where he said to Royce, "Look out, Royce, you're being photographed. I say, damn the absolute." Now, this is William James. He was a very feisty American philosopher and psychologist who liked to bring humor into the discussion about religion. And there's a bit of a trickster in him as well, an American trickster. Of course, that was blasphemous for him to say that, and he knew it. And he said, if I offend anyone's feelings in one of his lectures, in anything he said about the divinity, he asked pardon for saying it. But you see why his fight with his friend was so important in opening up what now we know as the field of transpersonal psychology. It's a field of research into the transpersonal states of mind and transpersonal values, looking at them across all cultures. James said also in his paper, Reason and Faith, to give up one's concept of being good is the only door to the universe's deeper reaches. So there's that. you like that? To give up one's concept of being good is the only door to the universe's deeper reaches. Now, Abraham Maslow would later write his book, The Further Reaches of Human Experience. So you see the idea of the reaches and how these two movements in the history of American psychology and spirituality right around 1900 and then again in the 1960s, you could say there's waves or movements of ideas that have points of emergence, and so I'm going back to the roots in order for you to see that there are times in history when ideas just suddenly become emergent, and this was certainly an emergent time in America. He said also, the God of any one religion is, quote, an improbable hypothesis. So he's using scientific language again to form his arguments. Now, as I mentioned, Carl Jung was strongly influenced by William James. Here's a quote from Jung now, from his 1927 paper, Mind and Earth, after he had been to Taos, New Mexico in 1925. He says, any absolutist attitude is always a religious attitude. And in whatever respect a man becomes absolute, there you see his religion. Now, I'm not going to speak much about Jung's psychology today because it would take us into a different direction. But by that, Jung also meant, in a horrifying way, that there's a dark side of God. And whatever one becomes absolutist about becomes a religious attitude. And as terrible as this is to say, for Jung that would also mean Hitler and Nazism and the swastika and his absolutist ideas. So that's another subject, and it would just take us into a dark direction right now. But the positive psychology, the optimism that William James brought to American psychology, is something that he can really be remembered for. Here's another interesting quote. He says, only thoroughgoing monists or pantheists believe in the absolute. The God of our popular Christianity is but one member of a pluralistic system. Now, just a brief I'm going to skip that part about Jung right now. So let me ask a question here. Do studies in Buddhist and Vedantic meditation practices have anything significant to offer us that James and Jung left out of their empirical explorations? Can the subconscious be the object of scientific investigation? Now, in Jung's seminars in 1932 on Kundalini Yoga, Jung talked about the different chakra systems, and he's gone through his seminar and he's talking about Muladhara, which is the base chakra at the lowest part of the collective psyche or the body, then he's talking about the two zones of the Ajna center, which is the third eye, and then the thousand-petaled lotus at the crown of the head. And this is what Jung had to say about these two centers. He said that those two centers don't have any relevance for Western psychology. The two levels of the higher self Jung left out of the aims of Jungian analysis are: one, the higher realizations located in the region of the forehead, the chakra 6 or the Ajna center, and two, the ultimate point of liberation, chakra 7 or the crown area, Sarasrara, the thousand-petaled lotus. With regards to the crown chakra at the top of the head, the center Jung correctly identified with enlightenment, or nirvana, he says simply that, quote, it is without practical value for us. So you see how, although Jung and James were the father and the grandfather of transpersonal psychology, Jung drew a line of demarcation between Eastern spirituality practices and analytical depth psychology. And this is an important thing that is being discussed by transpersonal psychologists. Jung said this in 1932, that when one has reached the Ajna center, the third eye of cosmic consciousness or intuition, the ego has become nothing but the self. But in the Ajna center, Jung wrote, the psyche gets wings. Here, you know, you are nothing but psyche. So Jung didn't think the attainment of the higher levels of transpersonal consciousness were possible for Westerners. And this is a question, actually. He wrote further in this context, and here's where we get into the discussion. Hopefully we can engage in this question during the conversation that we have later. Jung wrote, we are reaching into the remote future of mankind or of ourselves. Now he's talking about the seventh chakra, sixth and seventh. For any man has at least the potential faculty to experience that which will be the collective experience in 2,000 years, perhaps in 10,000 years.
Stephen, you have just a little over 5 minutes before
Alrighty,
we should
thank
take
you.
Questions.
Okay, I'm getting close here. Now, when we're talking about the higher chakras, we're talking about what Swami Vivekananda and the Vedanta refers to as the superconscious. Jung did say there's a superconscious in the unconscious. He said this later on, after his trip to India in 1937. But in considering the psychology of the future and what it might be, it's important to ask the question about how the two currents in the field of transpersonal psychology diverge on this point, and how that's created a need for a non-dual approach to bring them together somehow. And that's being written about currently. So it was a pleasure for me to give the talk at Sophia University and to be able to teach the works of William James, who's often forgotten in the discussion about transpersonal psychology. Here's one quote from Vivekananda that I'll leave you with before I end. When Swami Vivekananda was asked the question, if you ever reach the state of superconsciousness, can you ever tell about it? Now, this is a very significant question that was asked to him at Harvard University in 1896, because who was in the audience? William James. This is Vivekananda's answer. No, but we know it by its fruits. Now, by their fruits you shall know them. I mean, this is, we know where that comes from. So that was a great answer, I think. But it also shows a humility in Vivekananda that he didn't presume to be the all-knowing omniscient Brahman either all the time. He also was very interested in the science of religion, and he spoke about this. And he said the future of psychology will be the study of the superconscious. So you see, that was his yoga. That was his, and later Aurobindo would really take that forward. So that gives you an overview of where my thoughts are going in this discussion today, and I'd like to open this up now to a discussion. Yes, this. Thank you very much. Thank you.
I'm sorry, Ray. I got the mic on you.
Oh my!
And I have to go greet Stephen. Thank you so much.
You're welcome.
You're going to have to help me phrase this question, because it's tied to Unitarian Universalism, having the multiple doors and the small Q, where we have Freud saying that the basic needs of a human being, we have Maslow saying there's a hierarchy of human needs. In other words, absolutes in terms of a kind of a parental need for an energy for a parental constancy. Mm-hmm. And so we see human beings going for an absolute a lot, you know, mm-hmm. in mm-hmm. there's Jesus or there's Buddha or there's mm-hmm. Muhammad. So is this such a core need mm-hmm. that even though James is saying, and we all know, and as Unitarians mm-hmm. we know, that there's these multiple doors.
Mm-hmm.
to infinity, but what if it, our human need is saying, but we have to have an absolute? What's the resolution with that?
I think you answered your question beautifully. It's a very human need, Lonnie. And I think that Jung realized that when patients would come to him who had lost their faith and they had a bad neurosis, Jung would sometimes turn them away from analysis and send them back to the synagogue or to the church, you see. Because, of course, that's a healing path, and of course that's a path to the absolute, too. I think one can get to the universe through multiple doors or through a single door. I am the door, ye are the way.
But when we present multiple doors, people shy away.
Right.
You know, because they want one door.
Well, that's what, see, that's William James's argument, that that where religion needed to open up was around the multiple doorway metaphor. And that's his great contribution to modern psychology and science of religion. And I think what it also does is it takes the wind out of fundamentalism. It literally depotentiates any attempts to make any one religion the absolute for the world. And that's why we have the freedom of religion. That's why we have the First Amendment. Yes,
Beck. Sister, and I read Varieties of Religious Experience on drugs, on hashish. I happened to take hashish, and then I went upstairs and opened my William James. And I came, you know, in that altered state, I got this image of a great bowl. And the, here's the infinite, at the time I used the word God, trying to get to us. Mm. And he, she, it was using all these doors.
Wow.
And they became these symbols.
Mm.
And that's why we fight with each other.
Mm.
You know, and the bowl is culture that gets in the way.
Mm-hmm.
And we, you know, we have... Those doorways, you know, you have to get through somehow. Mm-hmm. I'm trying to, am I answering your question? But, and I, you just turned my bowl upside down. Mm. I used to be a dome and now it's a bowl just listening to you, so you blew my mind.
William James helped.
I'm sort of restless with the academic community on the subject of the exploration of the mind. The track that I'm following, along with a number of other associates, the most famous being Philip K. Dick, we think that we should be studying the people who are very prolific. The writers who seem to have an endless flow of ideas so that with the greatest of ease they can finish one novel and then roll the first sheet to the next novel into the typewriter and start typing and time after time produce some viable literary product. Mm. And these writers all say the same thing. Oh, it's not me that's writing all these books. It's somebody is dictating these books to me. And the concept which I and other friends of Philip K. Dick arrive at is that there are multiple universes.
Hmm.
And that when you open the door to these multiple universes, you can go in any one of a number of different directions because there isn't one single reality that we all have in common, but there is a strange world of spirits and ideas floating around, and we need only open the door and go through, and like Alice in Wonderland, we find ourselves in a strange but very productive land, following this line of thought. Philip K. Dick has become the most movieized writer of all time.
Hmm.
By writing one novel after another in that way, just rolling one out and another one in. Yeah, and he has also studied other writers who are also prolific. And one of them, for example, is L. Ron Hubbard, who developed an alternate religion based upon his what he saw when he went through that door, and he was one of those writers who was immensely prolific. So I think I would like to see more study of those people who tap into those resources that are to be found on the other side of that door.
Well, thank you.
On the question of the mini doors,
yes,
One of our teachers here at the Unitarian Church who was very close to us was Houston Smith.
Oh, yes.
And he, in his lifetime, celebrated and delved into the many doors of religious experience in all different traditions. Mm-hmm. And but in his latter years, I believe, he found his original door, the Methodist faith, mm-hmm. to be just as valid and as important to him as ever. Mm-hmm. So his appreciation of the many doors did not invalidate any of them, and mm-hmm. he kept celebrating his original, I think. I think that's true.
Well, I've been wanting to speak, but I am Houston Smith's wife.
Oh.
At this point, widow. I found this fascinating.
Thank you.
In part because I feel like you were sketching part of my life. I've spent time in the Aurobindo ashram.
Oh, really?
I took all the psychedelics with
really?
Tim Leary
oh, wow.
and so forth. I also envy you your knowledge.
Oh.
This was fascinating. I didn't know that Aurobindo was a part of, contributed to this,
oh, huge.
Which I find very interesting. Mm-hmm. I wondered, you mentioned Josiah Royce.
Yes.
You didn't mention William Ernest Hocking, and I wondered if he was part of this too. He was a younger contemporary of Royce,
mm-hmm.
an idealist.
Mm-hmm.
I do have a question. It's not directly connected with your talk today. But it's a question I'm interested in. For me, the Freudian sketch of what the infant is like maps onto original sin
mm-hmm.
Very clearly. The Eastern Hindu Buddhist notion is quite different. And I wonder if Jung ever wrote or seemed to think about the what the innate drives and propensities of an infant are? That's my question.
Of an infant?
Yeah. I don't know if...
Infinite?
Infant, baby.
That's what I thought
baby.
You said, yes.
Yeah, baby. I don't know if... I'm just wondering if he ever addressed himself to that. And I should think transpersonal psychologists... Well, I would count myself one, but I've never seen any writing by any of them on this. But I may have missed it. I'm long retired.
The question then is Jung's thoughts about the drives of the infant.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Jung wrote a... he actually gave a seminar in 1939 on children's dreams. This is right after his Nietzsche seminar, which was a 5-year seminar. And it went on for a year to 1940, so this is after the outbreak of World War II. Jung wrote there about dreams of children from his research of a number of reminiscences of dreams in adults. There were a couple of examples of children's dreams that he had from reports from parents and colleagues reporting about their children. What he said is that the psyche of the child can sometimes have what he called prospective dreams, by which he means a big dream. He distinguished between little dreams and big dreams. The big dreams are the transpersonal or collective dreams. The prospective function or teleological function of the unconscious can foresee future developments in a child's life. Jung wrote not much about infancy, but he did write about very early childhood. And in his autobiography, Memories, Dreams, Reflections, Jung gives an example of the very first dream he had from the age of 3 of a of an underground grave phallos, which was enormous, he said, 11 feet tall, sitting on a golden throne with an aura of light above its head. And when he had, as a child of five, his mother gave him a copy of the Orbis Pictus, which was a book about the a picture book containing images of Brahma, Shiva, and Krishna. And when he saw the pictures of Shiva and he saw the lingam, he made the connection in his mind between that dream and his. Now, this dream actually helped him. He kept it secret, first of all, until after midlife, and then he began speaking with people about it, but only very close people he trusted. As Marie-Louise von Franz writes, his follower and one of his most prolific, speaking of prolific writers, that this was a dream of his future destiny, and it pointed to the whole future of his life, and in a way became part of his need to argue for the existence of another side of the divinity, of the God image, that was in the earth, in the matriarchal unconscious, as he called it, and that pointed the way to his future illumination or development of consciousness. Jung's whole psychology is the psychology of the evolution of consciousness. The one follower in the archetypal field of analytical psychology who wrote the most about infancy was his follower Eric Neumann, the Israeli analyst in The Origins and History of Human Consciousness. That's the book where the word transpersonal keeps showing up again and again. He's the one who took this idea of Jung's the furthest, and later he wrote a book called The Child. But on the other side of the fence was the developmental, the more Freudian psychoanalytic Jungian, Michael Fordham, and he did what now is very popular in Jungian institutes, which is infant observation, and brought in Melanie Klein's ideas about the infant, and wrote the most, I would say, about the significance of infancy on later development. So it's a very interesting question. I thank you for it. I hope that answers the question.
We have time for one quick question, so if anybody has a pressing... Okay.
Hello. I was just pondering super consciousness and listening to you talk about an infant. And as a mother, the first time I saw my child, I thought about what it might mean to be completely conscious as a baby and not have to express anything at all, and how we forget as we grow and we experience tiny traumas over time that kind of steal our consciousness. And so when we have this pure form in front of us that's been newly created, that they have everything, but we can somehow not reach it. So that's
very interesting. Yeah.
Well, thank you so much, Stephen, again.
You're welcome. Yeah, thanks for having me again. Yeah.